You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, March 5th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, Adolph Reed Jr., his piece, the cover story of this month's Harper's Magazine, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals. Also on the program today, breaking, Paul Ryan, still a joke and still taken seriously after all these years by the corporate media. Minimum wage push gaining more traction. Want a good example of whether or not it impacts jobs? Look to Washington State. Meanwhile, Mickey D's feeling the pressure of wildcat strikes, maybe raising wages in the near future. And the CIA, you remember them. People forgot that the CIA also engaging in all sorts of horrendous activities. Not only has the Senate report on their torture regime been suppressed, but apparently the CIA may have been, and it appears, and it's, again, this is cloudy, we will talk about it more, has been spying on the oversight committee that was building that torture report. And the heartwarming story of a U.S. attorney who refuses to accept the fact that we have changed, at least on the federal level, the policy that we should be taking towards people who work in marijuana dispensaries, sends a low-level marijuana dispensary worker to 2 years in prison, even though, according to the state of California, this guy did nothing wrong. And lastly, as we see the corporate reports come out, Chipotle has a message for those climate change deniers. Enjoy your tacos without guacamole. We will get into that later in the program. Just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. One, happy birthday to my sister, Julie. I don't even know how old she is today, but she's 1 year older. It's her birthday, so happy birthday to you, Julie. I love you.
Happy birthday, Julie.
She's one of my most faithful fans. And also,
she's my favorite show. I am her, by the way, when she just one liner trashes you. I love it. It's great.
Yes, she does that constantly. And then she emails us at our show email with complaints all the time. She's one of our biggest complainers, too, on the show. I also want to take this moment to thank a longtime supporter of this program who has given this program an incredible amount of support. Listener Janet, she's also provided me with one of my favorite anecdotes that I have told over the years. And she's also been a big supporter of Mike Malloy's and other progressive talkers. She and her late husband Daniel were fans of Air America, and she has just been incredibly generous with the support. And I long overdue for a shofar blast. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Adolph Reed. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, Adolph Reed Jr., on his cover piece in Harper's Magazine, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you, and thanks again for having me.
I really enjoyed your piece, and I've also been really sort of fascinated in some ways by the criticism of the piece. But we will get to that in a bit. But let's start with what has been the long, slow surrender of American liberals.
Well, I guess in a nutshell, I would say that it's we've been coerced, herded ourselves into accommodation with the agendas of a Democratic Party. Ultimately, that's been moving farther and farther to the right. Made its concessions with neoliberalism at some point in the 80s. Consolidated it in the Clinton presidency, and that's kind of set the terms of debate for us.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the things that I think, you know, that really resonated with me in your piece has been the perspective. I mean, Bill Clinton remains incredibly popular in Democratic circles, and
right.
I think even it's fair to say, although I haven't seen any specific data on this. Even in self-identified liberals, and some of the criticism I've seen of your piece claims that that's not the case, and I simply have found it to be the case, frankly, that you know it's impossible to hear anybody mention welfare reform without it being lauded. It has been particularly now really shown to be quite disastrous. But just go through, what do you think happened? I mean, what was it that Clinton did that was obviously, and I think many of the people in the audience is aware of it, but how did that, did it go through some type of revision, or it seems like contemporaneous, there was also sort of an acceptance at that time?
Well, yes, there was. I mean, I think part of the problem is that, I think in a way it can start. I mean, the narrative could start earlier, of course, but, you know, it can always start earlier. Getting over the shock of Reaganism, I think, knocked a lot of liberals for a loop and knocked, frankly, a lot of the left for a loop. I was just talking with a student last night about how some of us, a lot of us in the 70s, for instance, were spent a lot of time trying to sharpen critiques of the social welfare state in the U.S. from a left egalitarian perspective. And then all of a sudden we look up and Reagan is inaugurated and goes after every bit of social protection, or begins to go after every bit of social protection that we built up since the New Deal. And then people like me and a lot of others, Fran Piven, for instance, is a central person, found ourselves in a position of having to defend, right, to hunker down and defend these institutions that we'd been trying to develop a more progressive critique of. And it's not like there's disingenuousness. So in that sense, I think maybe, to be fair, a lot of people wound up somewhat like deer in the headlights. Also, in the late 70s and the early 80s, big employers went, not least the federal government with Reagan and the air traffic controllers, but went on the offensive against the labor movement. And the trade union sector got put on the defensive, and this is a period of concessionary bargaining. It kicked off, and we're still in it. So the labor movement was back on its heels, and other sources of potential left criticism and political opposition were stymied, didn't know how to react, were in disarray, and significant elites within the Democratic Party began to target new constituencies and, to compete with the Republicans for what was basically a suburban, socially liberal, economically neoliberal constituency. The Democratic Leadership Council, which was created after Mondale's defeat in 1984, of which both Clinton and Gore were presidents, was formed expressly to push the National Democratic Party's agenda to the right, especially on economic issues, although many of them wanted to push it to the right on social issues. And then I think that after Carter's defeat, Mondale's defeat, and Dukakis's defeat, Clinton got to look like a stud to a lot of liberals just because he won. And that just goes, so a problem there is that if you define the standard of success downward, so that any Democrat who can win office is our charger, that's another illustration of the problem. But with respect to the Clinton administration in particular, I'll just pick up on your point and say yes. I mean, under Clinton, we saw, as you noted, with respect to so-called welfare reform, the elimination of the federal government's 60-year commitment to provide income support for the indigent, and also the undercutting of the federal government's commitment almost as long to direct provision of affordable housing for the poor in the Hope Six program, which really took off under the Clinton administration. NAFTA, which he pushed through over the opposition of many congressional Democrats. When we look at the student loan crisis now, the Clinton administration was central in the privatization of Sallie Mae, the student loan company that grossly or wildly expanded high interest unsubsidized student loans and fuel that. We can go on with his support for financial deregulation, and which helped to give us first the tech bubble and burst, and then the housing bubble and burst. And he was by no means alone in those, but he was no less culpable than the Republicans were. And then, my God, on the foreign policy front, I mentioned in the essay that Clinton conducted almost as many military interventions overseas as Reagan and the first Bush combined, and in four fewer years. So as I and many others have said, it's kind of hard to imagine a Republican president who could have been more successful at pushing the Republican agenda during the 90s. So then the question becomes, why the nostalgia for him? And I think the answer is a combination of social amnesia, willful blindness, the reduction of the stakes of politics to just winning the office, right? And as the policy differences or the span of policy differences between Republicans and Democrats narrows on so many issues, it becomes our guy versus their guy. And I think, frankly, that many upper status Democrat voters of the new liberal sort are basically well off the professional and managerial class folks who like to think of themselves as better and more compassionate and more intelligent than their Republican neighbors, family members, and coworkers.
Well, and in some respects, they undoubtedly are. It's just that we have lost this notion of any type of class consciousness within the context of our politics. And and what's also, and I just to add, I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on Clinton, but what's also fascinating to me is that this is a guy who enters into office with a democratically controlled Senate and House and leaves without that. And somehow that never gets, I mean, even in the context of that dynamic, you know, we love him because he won. But in fact, there was a loss of the House and the Senate. But let's turn. I mean, the reason why I wanted to start with Clinton is just because I think ultimately, and I don't want to mischaracterize your piece, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it is incredibly important that we identify the difference between the Democratic Party and the left, if only because that's the way that without that awareness. It creates all sorts of problems in terms of getting to left objectives.
Yes, I think it's absolutely correct.
So let's go back to a little bit, because one of the things that and you touch on at least briefly in the piece is this sort of dynamic, and more so in the context of President Obama, but as far as I understand it, there was sort of a cleave that took place between those involved in social emancipation movements and those involved in sort of economic justice movements or even labor in the late 60s, early 70s. And that became sort of the decoupling of or the mutual, I don't want to say mutual exclusiveness, but the sort of the creating discrete silos within what we consider liberalism. Talk about that for a bit.
In fact, that's the subject of the book that I'm trying to finish now, which actually began as an examination of the Obama mania phenomenon. And the animating question is still the same, which is why did so many people who should have known better, good-hearted people who don't pay attention to politics or kids who don't know anything, but people who were politically sophisticated and have been around the lap a few, track a few laps, why did so many of such people get swept up in the hype about Obama when it was pretty clear to anybody who looked closely that he was just another, pretty ordinary neoliberal Democrat? And in trying to answer that question, I found myself going back to providing an account, actually, of the decline and transformation, because both things happened, of the left in the U.S. since the end of World War II. I very much appreciate your difficulty in characterizing what kind of relationship developed between the two tendencies, because it is very difficult to characterize, so I share it with you. I think you're right. It's not that they broke entirely, but I think that what's happened, and I think this has happened consistently since the late 40s, is that pushes or at the moments when an egalitarian left had some social and political momentum, and that momentum has been blocked or defeated, what's happened is that the forces pushing for egalitarian agendas didn't go away, but had to make accommodations to the new sets of rules, to put it kind of crudely, that the ruling capitalist class laid down. And one of the things that we find in a shift in the late 60s is the beginnings of the shift that eventually becomes identity politics, where there's a decoupling of the notion of racial inequality and injustice to some extent from a political economy. And then and at some point down the road, I think something kind of comparable happens with the women's movement. I think the environmental movement was a different kettle of fish altogether. There never was a sort of class conscious, and especially significant class conscious tendency in, or at least working class conscious tendency in environmental movement, where there have been in the others. As the political and economic order continued to evolve toward what we eventually came to recognize or call neoliberalism, all of the incentives ran for notions of social justice that were disconnected from your political economy. And that's, for instance, my good friend Walter Michaels, who's an English professor and also activist in the University of Illinois Chicago Faculty Union, which is in contract negotiations now for the first time with the university, but has argued that the problem with notions with multiculturalism or diversity as standards of justice and equality is that you can have a society in which 1% of the population controls 90% of the resources, but so long as that 1% is half female and 12% black and 12 or 13% Latino and whatever the appropriate numbers would be gay, then from the standpoint of a multiculturalist or a diversitarian notion of justice or equity, then then that would be a just society. And I think we can see how that has played itself out, right? That's kind of what the Democrats have come to offer us. That's as basically the left wing of neoliberalism. As I say in the essay, we find ourselves in national politics with a choice between one neoliberal party that is open and progressive, or that supports multiculturalism and diversity, and another neoliberal party that defines itself publicly by being opposed to multiculturalism and diversity. So I'm not saying that that's no choice, but for because obviously I think most of us would prefer the former to the latter, but for most of the things that 80% of the for 80% of the matters that 80% of the population is concerned about 80% of the time, the two parties agree, right? Job loss, no fair labor standards, cutting the public sector, down the line. I mean, people forget, for instance, that it's the Obama administration that is leading the charge on K through 12 public education all over the country now.
Yes, in terms of
prioritization and stuff. Right?
Is this something that has? I mean, because it's almost as if it has flipped in some way. Because I mean, there was when we're talking about the New Deal. There was concessions, and I don't. Maybe I'm not characterizing it correctly, but the idea that African Americans could participate in the New Deal was very problematic at the time, right? I mean, so those notions had to be cleaved from each other, and it's almost as if now the social emancipation movements, at least within the context of the Democratic Party, are used as a substitute. I mean, because I think about when Clinton came into office, You know, and I don't know that he made this choice, but certainly it was like the first hill that part of the Clinton administration, I don't want to say died on, but was the ideas of gays in the military.
Right.
And
right.
I look to today to our governor in New York State, Andrew Cuomo, who has been very good on marriage equality. Good on gun safety, but from an economic standpoint, has been, you know, I don't know that you could say he's been much better. Maybe he's been worse than Pataki. It's almost as if like this is a substitute for that, as opposed to being commingled.
Well, you know what? I mean, I think that's right. I mean, of course, you know, the evolution of the separation, you know, has happened over decades, right? And it's happened, I think, in part as rational responses on the part of activists to the matrix of incentives and disincentives that are available to them. I mean, for instance, in the late 1940s and the early 50s, there was considerable political and ideological pressure to separate, you know, from anti-communism, ultimately, to separate the civil rights agenda from a political economic one, right? Far be it for me ever to diminish the significance of the Jim Crow order in the South and of the struggle against it. But one of the one facet or byproduct of the shift in black politics in the late 40s to focusing on the challenge to Jim Crow was that it was consistent with, didn't ruffle Cold War liberal concerns because the opposition to, you know, Jim Crow as a legal order was struck in the name of liberal, you know, equality of opportunity, right? And I mean, who could oppose that except the people who are benefiting from it immediately in the South? But the problem is that the reduction of the notion of racial equality to equality of opportunity would mean ultimately that blacks would be integrated into, you know, the class, into the American class hierarchy on a relatively equivalent basis, which means that most black people would still be getting the short end of the stick, just like most white people would. And I know this is an oversimplification, but I think that over time, I'd like to say this, I hope it doesn't seem too cryptic, but I've come to think that just as important as the ways that progressive agendas have been defeated has been the terms on which they've been able to succeed within the framework of the larger defeat, right? That makes sense. So that there's space that's available for, you know, non-economic understandings of equality, and this just has taken off more and more and more. Just to kind of stress, the difference. This factoid just kind of boggles my mind. But a Roper poll taken the month before the 1944 presidential election found that 68% of respondents said that they wouldn't support a political and economic system, no matter what it was called, that didn't pivot on a guarantee that any person who was willing and able to work should have the right to a job. And, you know, this was the year before congressional Democrats, with the support of, you know, the CIO-based left, actually pushed for a full employment bill in 1945 that would have mandated that pursuit of full employment at a maximum of 3% and a goal of 2% would be the cornerstone of American economic policy. The following year, Walter Reuther, in contract negotiations with the United Auto Workers and GM, called for the company to open the books and jointly plan with the union profits and prices and wages, right, with an eye on containing inflation and keeping productivity up. So, I mean, that what I mentioned as factoids just as an illustration of how far the center of gravity of mainstream American politics has shifted, right, since 1945. I mean, the sensibility that's expressed in both those factoids, no doubt seems like it's unthinkable to the vast majority of Americans alive today.
What accounts for that? I mean, it's not that Democrats, have sort of given up that ballast. I mean, this is more a problem with the left, is this more of a cultural a problem? And I mean, what
that's a good question. Russell Jacoby, who I also quote in the article in this really interesting book called The End of Utopia, I think that's the title, makes the point that liberals are really only as good as the left that's to their left, and that liberals kind of define themselves as not being left and not being not being too far left and not being right, and as the institutional left has shriveled, atrophied, been beaten back increasingly since the 70s. There just hasn't been an institutional base to sort of pull the Democratic liberals along in the direction of something that looks more like a social democratic agenda. And I mean, it is important too that I think that Clintonism was, especially once he gained the White House, it was in effect a kind of putsch of the left wing of the Democratic Party. It was like the last gasp, right, what George Stephanopoulos at one point called those old time Democrats, not in a flattering or nostalgic way. I'm glad you mentioned the don't ask, don't tell thing about the military too, or whatever the thing was, because I was struck by that at the time. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't oppose him doing that, but I think it's really significant in the context of the congressional majority that he squandered that you mentioned before, because it almost seemed like he wanted to run out the clock and lose control of Congress so that he wouldn't have to come through on the fight for labor law reform that he promised the AFL-CIO. And I think there's something like that with Obama and the Employee Free Choice Act in 2008 too.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder. I mean, I've heard differing things. I mean, one, my sense is, and I'm not, as clear on how the gays in the military came about, and I don't know that it really was actually something that the Clinton administration wanted to push early on. I think they were sort of boxed in on it, if I recall correctly. And I have to say,
I think that's probably right.
And I think on EFCA, there was sort of a sense of, I'm not sure how broad really the passion was for it in terms of. Of Democrats, elected Democrats at the time, and
right.
It wasn't just something that, hey, this is a way we can motivate what's left of the union movement. But
oh, I think you're exactly right about that. I think that's exactly right. I don't think there's ever a snowball's chance in hell that Obama was going to support it, right?
Or
to fight for it. But this is the part of the problem, right? Because the labor movement and other left of center constituencies that actually have some constituents. You get boxed in like every 2 years or 4 years with this because you've got to find a way to encourage people to vote for the Democrat. But if you make claims that are too large about how important it is to elect a Democrat, then if you elect him and he sells you out, you can't really go back to your constituents and say, well, you know, the the bastard just sold us out, because that means that you look bad to them, right? Like either you're a liar to them or stupid, right? So
this is the central dilemma, though, isn't it? I mean, there was there was one, you know, Michelle Goldberg, I think, of The Nation, charged you with electoral nihilism, and I didn't read your piece as saying that. I mean, I think it was. My sense is that you're accepting the notion that there may, on election day, there may not be any other place to go. But
right.
The dilemma is exactly that.
Right.
There is,
it's
acknowledging there's no other place to go, and that in some ways, the beginning of dealing with that problem is that very acknowledgement and sort of embracing that ambivalence on some level.
Oh, no, I agree completely. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have said it more succinctly myself. I mean, and that isn't to say.
Hi, sorry, we lost you for a moment. So we were talking about that, embracing that ambivalence.
Right. Yeah, and I guess my point is that I agree with you. Right. That the point is to acknowledge that this is the conundrum that we're in, because that's the first step to trying to figure out ways to make it possible to do something else. Right. Because the point is to try to have influence on the terms of political debate ourselves from the standpoint of a progressive left vision of how the society could be better than it is. Yeah, I think Goldberg. I don't know. I mean, I think there's maybe kind of a confusion such that the notion of left. Might be understood to be the same thing as Brooklyn, a dilettante, but yeah, I mean, I think that was a misreading.
Well, yeah, and I mean, so this is all right. So let's start with that premise. I mean, this notion, and then you make it quite clear that, that it's important to identify where President Obama is on this spectrum, if only to say that he's not of the left or liberal. And I think this is not, you know, maybe in circles online, there is an awareness of that. But I think broadly speaking, that's not shared by most of the people who vote for him. And there seems to be a, you know, I think I read a transcript of an interview that you did on Bill Moyers, where you talk about the juxtaposition between President Obama talking about inequality in a speech, I think it was from December, and then heading over to the Hill and demanding fast track.
Right. It's mind-boggling, isn't it?
And I think the thing is that there's just not either an awareness, broadly speaking. Obviously, people who follow this stuff are aware of it, but there is not
right.
an awareness of the vast majority of people who continue to have full-throated support for the president.
Right.
On the implications of these issues, and is that a function, and I think largely that seems to me to be a function of the demise of the labor movement, because that's the place where you go in, you see your fellow workers, and
right.
That's what they're talking about.
Right. Yeah. No, that's right. No, yeah, but yeah, it's absolutely correct. I was going to say the same thing, actually. I think that's a key problem, and in the absence of that kind of institution, right, and its breadth within the society, what we get is this really hollowed out candidate-centered personality contest, and they're not even the real personalities. Of course, they're the personalities that are crafted by the handlers. That's how you wind up, with this kind of frustratingly circular argument that, well, you got to elect him, but you can't expect him to do anything, and you can't criticize him. Well, you can't expect him to do anything because the other side is too powerful, but you can't criticize him because he hasn't had a chance to do anything because the other side is so powerful. So you can't expect him to do anything, you can't criticize him for not doing anything, and you have to support him because the other side is attacking him and the other guy's worse, but you have to elect him. Or the other guys were, so you have to elect them. And it's just a merry-go-round. It's just astounding if you take a couple steps back from it. But I think one of the problems, to be honest, is You know, in a perverse way, I think MSNBC is kind of a tool of the right in the sense that, you know, not just because it does the same kind of work for, you know, Democrats that Fox does for, you know, for the Republicans, but just this, an approach to politics and to political events that just, you know, reduced to this sort of breathless babble of ultimately meaningless factoids, right? And the notion that, you know, being progressive is like being au courant with like every little twist and turn in the horse race aspects of politics and the kabuki theater, like around the budget, you know, showdowns and that kind of stuff. And that's what most people have. That's what most people who consider themselves Democrats or left of center have access to that in the nation, you know, as a way of trying to get their, or that pretends to take the place of the labor press and the trade union culture that you mentioned earlier, and that's a tremendous loss, right? And I mean demobilization in minority communities and all that kind of stuff has happened too, which carries the same tendon or has the same effect as a you know, the atrophy of the trade union culture.
And so what is, I mean, so with that, once you start with the idea that, you know, step one is at least identifying the shortcomings mm-hmm. of those politicians who are really in at this moment may be the only option, you know, the mm-hmm. lesser of two evils. What happens then?
Well, then I think what has to happen, and I think, you know, I mean, I'm not the sort, I don't have enough of an imagination to, you know, lay out, you know, a grand vision of you know, what we should do. But I think what has to happen is that people who are committed and are politically serious, and that means, you know, especially in relation to the labor movement, because I think that's got to be the anchor of any sort of you know, rebuilt or a renewed left, just as a renewed left is it has to be part of the grounding of a revitalized trade union movement. To, you know, to begin to talk strategically about things we can do. I mean, I was involved for a number of years with an effort to build an independent labor party, which, you know, didn't succeed ultimately, and there are reasons that it didn't, and it's worth considering those too. But I mention that because one thing I think that we were correct about was that the key to building the broad kind of class, working class based broad social and political movement that we need doesn't run through the electoral arena. It runs through social movement organizing around, you know, most likely around issue-based campaigns that cut very widely. I mean, one of them that we thought, you know, that may have less potential now than it did before Obamacare, but may have more potential again soon because of the limitations of Obamacare, is a single-payer healthcare movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked about others' push for a revitalized public sector and, you know, I mean, decommodification of public services, although, you know, that's not a good slogan, but you get the idea.
Right.
And, you know, things like that, right? I mean, the impulse has to be to try to build politically around pursuit of issues that connect with the as broadly as possible within the broad class of us who are expected to work for a living every day, right, to get up and go to work every day. I think among the reasons that the labor movement has to be central to that kind of undertaking are, one, the foundations aren't going to fund that kind of movement, so, and you need to have resources. Two, as much as many you know, left types sneer at how weak and small the trade union movement is, I always say, well, compared to what? So what else you got, right?
Right.
There are millions of working people in unions who don't just live at the workplace, right? As you indicated, they have family, friends. They're in bowling leagues and little leagues and wine sipping clubs or whatever, right? And that's a base of organizing and talent, like as well as a base of resources. And it's also, the identity as a worker or a person, if one would prefer, who's expected to work for a living, that cuts most broadly through the majority of the American population, and that's actually the basis for building solidarity. So, I think that's the direction that we need to try to go into, and understanding that that's a long-term undertaking. But as I often say, we didn't get into this position overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight. And while understanding at the same time that the electoral realm is going to be what the electoral realm is until we can build something strong enough to change it, and what that means is that between now and then, what electoral politics is going to be all about is the lesser of two evils, and the vast majority of time, that lesser is likely to be a Democrat. I lived in Connecticut in the 80s, so I understand very well that every now and again, the lesser evil is going to be a Republican.
Right.
And as I said, I am still proud not ever to have voted for Joe Lieberman. For
well, I was in college in Connecticut in the 80s and developed my distaste for Joe Lieberman, just watching him doing late night commercials and somehow taking credit as the Attorney General for the tolls being removed from the toll roads.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot all about that.
But yeah. Well, let me ask you this. How do you respond to some of the criticism I've seen of the piece that you don't acknowledge that some of what you're talking about is happening now? I mean, I guess today there was a story about the quarterly report, I think, from McDonald's suggesting that they may have to raise wages basically because of it's been a labor, broadly speaking, a labor movement, the strikes and the adoption at the least of Democrats, broadly speaking, of the minimum wage. We've got a candidate in Kentucky running on raising the minimum wage. I mean, is some of that happening now?
Yes. In fact, I was just emailing with a friend of mine about that question a little while ago. I mean, some things are happening, right? I mean, I never intended to argue that, there's nothing going on. But what I would say, though, is that, there's a tendency for that kind of activity I have two things to say. One is that there's a tendency for that kind of activity to become trapped in the issue silos that you mentioned, right? And what we need is like a larger vision for transformation and a program, right? And one might say, well, it's possible that these efforts will generate that a vision. I think that's a different I think that's a perspective also that that I tend to identify with Alinskyism, and I think it's kind of a romantic one, or it's both romantic and technicistic at the same time, in the sense that the technique doesn't produce the program, right? So I mean, I think that what we need is a way to harness these initiatives that you mentioned, and others like them, like the Worker Center stuff, and others, but to harness them to a broader working class, political agenda.
In that regard, I mean, how do you see Elizabeth Warren? I mean, because on one level, there's at least been she has been used by the left as a way of saying, I'm of the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party.
Right.
I mean, to sort of make that differentiation. But give me, tell me your perspective on what she represents and how that fits into what you perceive needs to happen.
Right. Well, sure. I mean, I don't have any beef with Warren. I think, you know, she's, you know, I think she's a good person. It sounds like she's playing a good role in the Senate. I frankly don't know enough about her her economic orientation, right, to get too excited or frightened, or to get frightened by it. I've not seen it, but I haven't seen anything that leads me to think that she has or would have a kind of a desirably social democratic economic perspective, right? So I don't know. But I will say this, though. Irrespective of whatever Warren's merits are on her own, I think that tendency to look for, you know, the lightning rod is a huge problem. I mean, and I'll give you a comparable illustration. Wendy Davis in Texas, right? So she's all of a sudden a star and carrying the hopes and dreams of liberal or left liberal Dems, and it turns out she's basically a Republican, and as soon as she declared for governor, she began to backtrack from the stuff that had made her nationally prominent in the first place. And that just happens over and over and over. I mean, it happened with Obama and with others, and it's that's a curious thing about it, right, that there just doesn't seem to be a learning curve, right, because each instance is de novo, right?
So we don't want to necessarily be part of the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party. We want to be part of the egalitarian left or the wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I feel a lot more comfortable with that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's a good point. I mean, that is the one thing that I have to say, and I think more confidence in her economic policies, at least based on what I've seen, whether it's from the setting up the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau and her pursuit of banks. I'm less comfortable with that being the brand.
I got you. Yep. But I'm with you on that too. And like I said, I'm not enthusiastic. Mainly because I'm agnostic. I just don't know enough about her, really.
Well, the piece is fascinating. I know it's behind it's in the print edition of Harper's. So folks are going to have to buy some paper, I guess, to read it.
The workers have to get paid, you know.
Indeed. Adolph Reed Jr., I appreciate your time today. The piece is The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals. Thanks so much for coming on and talking about it.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. It was a pleasure. It's a true delight. You're my favorite.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. All right, we'll do it again soon once book comes
so.
Up.
Yeah.
All right.
Great. Bye-bye. Thanks.
All right, folks. We got to take a break. We will head into the funner half of the program, where
maybe I'm just so excited to hear about what the CBO report you're going to be talking about or something. I was just getting ready for those fun half plugs.
There was. What were we going to do?
I think we got to get to the Elijah Cummings sound pretty fast.
The Elijah Cummings sound.
A lot of people
talk
about that.
We should also probably talk about, I mean, now that Lindsey Graham has really basically blown the lid off of this whole.
That is a fun half.
What's that? The Benghazi stuff. And we will.
When you let Benghazi happen, oh, Lord, everything just comes along.
Maybe
with
we'll
that.
Even hear from, we'll hear your Putin impression
Maybe, you know what, with Lindsey Graham, that's a great reason to bring back my Southern female voice.
There you go.
Listen, I think the thing we have going on in this office with Michael Putin is the greatest thing we have ever produced on this show.
We may have some audio of Putin basically conceding that this whole Crimea thing was a function of Benghazi. So... Folks, this program depends on your support to continue and to grow. I just saw somebody sent me a link that Apple has some deal where they're going to be putting in some device into people's cars where you're going to be able to play. I mean, we are, you know, I've always said when we started this program that we were 5 to 10 years away from basically radio being supplanted in a car. It won't be supplanted, but it will be joined in the car by online streaming and podcasting, on-demand listening. When that happens, my hope is that there will be, you know, I mean, I think I'm well-positioned just because of my age, really.
And everyone made fun of Sam as he said this, as he rocked back and forth in a corner, repeating it to himself over
That's right,
and
they still make fun of me for saying that, and justifiably so, but we're... We're probably a couple of years away from that, but as the show grows, you know, we've seen we have something over 4,000 people just using the app alone, which you can get at majorityapp.com. But as the show grows, you know, and our message, we will be able to bring the voices that we bring on this program into people's cars and into people's homes in a way that is just not possible in other ways. So it is your support that will make this possible. You can become a member today at majority.fm. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, which, you know, not a huge fan of Amazon's labor practices, but if you're doing it anyways, the least you can do is give us a kickback so we can report on how their labor practices are not great. You can do that at majorityreportkickback.com. You just click on the Amazon link, you bookmark it. Anything you buy through Amazon, we get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's employee owned. They pay a fair wage to the people who pick and roast their coffee. And it's also great coffee. And you get 10% off using the coupon code MAJORITY. Leave us a good review on iTunes. That helps. Pick up the app. DonateYourAccount.com/MajorityFM. All that and more. We're going to head into the better half. You want to give a call, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at MajorityFM or via the app. We'll be back in just a moment.